were reflecting on the exhibits, and I was mindful that I had put an exhibit to Miss Foster. Well, it wasn't an exhibit, it was the Ashburton Lake document.
Yes.
I just wanted to note that that's actually a reference in Dr. Stewart's evidence.
Yes.
So I just wanted
to I didn't think that, because it is referred to by various people and it's a publicly available document, I didn't think it needed to be an exhibit.
Thank you, sir.
And we've probably kept our copy handy to.
Thank you, sir. And finally, I do have spare copies of the code of practice if the court need a copy, a hard copy, before this. This is the
which we have in the electronic form.
If you want a hard copy, sir, I've got that here.
You might keep those.
Thank you, sir. Mr.
Pennell.
Thank you. Just a quick view on my farmer. Without representation, so I've been given the privilege of asking questions. So really it's one of how your mitigation options for settlement, how transferable do you think they would be to the farming setting, given that Schedule C has got minimum setback for cultivation, as you rightfully point out, it doesn't do much for concentrated flows. Just wondering whether that is a better option of the certifier being able to prescribe mitigations for purchase.
So, with reference to cultivated production, cultivation is kind of cultivation. You should be able to dip into your toolbox of mitigations, a canning of farm will work equally well on a farm or a commercial vegetable production.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Now, on parents,
thank you, sir. Good morning, Mr. Barber. Just going to ask you a few questions. Firstly, in terms of the use of scorecards, so you, at a principled level, I took your question or your answers this morning to be that you see the use of risk scorecards as preferable to model tools such as Overseer in terms of the link between on-farm mitigation techniques and how that could deliver in-stream improvements. Is that a fair reflection of it?
They have two different purposes, so I don't think we should kind of get those two conflated. A risk assessment tool is the first step in a farm environment plan, and it's used to ensure that whichever mitigation you choose are proportionate. That is the role of the tool, which is quite different to an Overseer or a model.
Sure. And in terms of the basic rationale for the need to develop a scorecard for CDP, presumably that's because there can be significant risks associated with CDP.
Yeah, like many farm locations, certainly.
Yes. In your evidence, you've referenced briefly Plan Change 2, and maybe to assist the court, are you just able to explain the role that the CVP scorecard is supposed to have within PC2?
So Horizon PC2 had the expert competing as part of that development, also keeping in mind that these things evolve and get better, but that was the foundation, the basis of that risk assessment, and kind of like I referred to, but I think it's a significant step forward because it absolutely ensures that the mitigators are proportionate to the level of risk.
And so you support it, but the use of the scorecard within the planning framework.
And industry does like this. That while this is a new scorecard, scorecards, risk assessments are the foundation of EPP. It's step one in the EPP.
Then in terms of Plan Change 2, its role within Plan Change 2 is as a drafting gate, doesn't it?
An address site as planning, right?
The use of the risk scorecard or the SBS, for example, there's nothing within the Plan Change 1 provisions that require those to be used, though, is there?
Well, they, again, possibly a planning question, but if I go out on a limb, if NPP is required, then the use of those risk tools and an appropriate budget is required as part of the NPP, so yes, they are.
So if there were if they weren't specifically referenced as being required in the development of a FEP for CVP in PC1, would your view be that they should be?
Yeah, well, it's probably been there for a long time. But that's absolutely part of the FEP. And like I say, one line is in the checklist, but what sits behind below that one line of you need to have a much in budget is.
Certainly. And as far as the various components of the scorecard, was I right in thinking that your view was that the nitrogen budgeting requirement was essentially the most significant and important aspect of the CVP scorecard?
Absolutely. Nitrogen budgeting is the foundation for that. Talk about the round table discussion, right? The knowledge base. But so is all testing, right? That's the measured numbers being given the modern numbers every time.
Certainly. That's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Russell's evidence, she talks about the at paragraph 29, she talks about the risk scorecard and says that it's under development. And she also goes on to talk about the MFE risk score tool, that is also under development. Have you been involved in discussions on that at all?
Certainly not the MFE one, but I understand it is under development. But I think very good for this one.
Right. And so you wouldn't be able to comment on whether in its current form or in upgrades in the future it might be suitable for vegetables?
Yeah, I like that. I can't complain. I hope they might not be able to.
I beg your pardon?
They might not be able to.
Well, if I can turn to your one, so that's been developed primarily in the Plan Change 2 Horizons Regional Council process.
That's great.
Through joint witness conferencing, where yourself, you were involved with Potatoes New Zealand, I understand.
Multiple groups, point of watching New Zealand Potatoes New Zealand.
And Mr. Ford?
Correct.
And Marie Jolly for Horizons Regional Council?
Correct.
And the planners in...
And Brent Clavier from Part of Rest.
Yes. And planners that have attended that conference that have included Christine Foster for Horizons Regional Council and Liz Ruston. And so those experts agreed to a certain point system, didn't they, where points would be allocated to various categories and subcategories?
That's correct.
and the points are based on the productive area of the farm.
Correct. And there's a definition in there about what that area is.
Can you just provide information as to whether the points would reward a cultivation setback?
No, because cultivation setback is a mitigation for sediment control, not for
in paragraphs 46 to 47 of your evidence, you discuss the process where that was adapted, if you like, for the Waikato.
Correct.
So you say that it was tested amongst a limited number of growers.
Correct.
When was that carried out?
It's been over the last few months, so I'm going to say over the last 6 months probably.
And how many growers was it tested with?
I cannot remember exactly, but in the VIN there were at least initially 6 growers, and then the horticulture industry has a program called Grow and Change, which has advisors going up the drive, and has been tested amongst another 4 or 5 growers in that region, and the Grow and Change team also tested it within the Waikato growers. I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to say in the region of half a dozen.
Thank you. And does it take into account biophysical risk factors, rainfall and soils?
It does to a certain extent. So in Horizons 2's version, there is a table 2 that has a matrix that has plant available water and rainfall, and essentially in those crossovers there's different points allocated based on the bio and the biophysical. So you need to achieve a lower point, and by lower points you need to have more mitigations and things like that. Where for example the plant available water is low and there's high rainfall.
And that's because it's been adjusted for the Waikato, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So all these things go through iterations. The latest version that we're presenting next week after it's out of BC2 is called that put into it.
But not this one?
Not the current version of this one, because the current version of this one is what was the previous current version of the Horizons one. It's a little bit like when it's cut right, it's too by charge. Things progressively get better. So,
okay.
I guess on that point, the idea behind it is that these risk assessments drive or point to mitigation. So I think the latest version should be what's referred to. And I would suspect in time that risk assessment will get built into the NZ Gap Farm Environment Plan. It's already got a risk assessment in there. I just think this one hasn't worked. It's just with time.
And you've said in answer to questions that you see the dots aren't joined up with the tolls and what the nature you get.
Yeah.
And the water, and that comment would also apply to at the red zone, wouldn't it? Because your decision support toll for EVPs and locations.
And just reiterate this, what the environment says in the system is improvement, but not seeing the number that we bring up. And we will, with this tool and ECS, we will improve nitrogen optimisation.
Thank you. So that's all on that topic. Now, just briefly on the matter of cultivation setbacks, you've discussed with Ms. Tumai the generalised flow of issues. In the 2014 erosion and sediment control guidelines for vegetable production, which you immediately involved with, that recommends vegetation buffer strips and riparian margins adjacent to waterways should be at least 3 to 6 metres wide. Why was that 3 to 6 metres chosen?
Based on the best knowledge at the time, you'll see that that the evidence has been, or the paper that's produced about the beach of the strip code of practice, an update on the 2014.
The 3 to 6 metres wide provides, the 3 to 6 metres provides the dominant role in sediment trapping, doesn't it?
In a situation where the beach of strip was appropriate, that's right. I think that's the evidence that we produced for the latest version of the beach of strip. The sweet point was 4 to 6. The sweet point was 4 to 6 metres.
4 to 6, okay. And so you've provided evidence that there are other tools that you could use, such as decanting earth bunds, sediment ponds, etc.
Mm-hmm.
On a paddock-wide paddock analysis?
So our bottom plans are based on a paddock assessment because every paddock is different.
Yeah. In the 2014 guideline release, and I want to get your view on this, that apart from the sediment sort of infiltration and trapping,
mm-hmm.
riparian margins also have other values, don't they? Such as stabilising banks and shading streams.
Yes.
And
well, it's a tree line, not a lot of shading going on the grass, okay.
Yes. And the other issue that Mr. Tomar's raised with you is around sensitive fish spawning sites, such as and you'll be aware of the issues with the need for buffers at Inanna spawning sites. And I think you said that that would be provided in the CCCV, that sort of information. And do you know whether the Regional Council has identified those sites in the Waikato region? Thank you.
Thank you. Not here. Any reexamination?
Please, thank you. Thanks to Ferguson. Indicated he didn't have any questions for any of the witnesses today.
Thank you.
You were asked a moment ago about how many growers your tool was tested on, and you said it was about half a dozen. And that's in terms of the number of growers, but did you have a comment on the area or coverage of land over which those half a dozen growers represent?
That thought flashed in my mind. The area represented by those half a dozen growers or so would be something you own. Your questions on the growers today, I'm not sure what area represented by the growers talking is happening, but
in terms of the one that you did the testing on?
I can't think of a number, but you only have talked to 2 growers or 3 growers and you've covered a significant amount of the area.
Okay, well, can I refresh your memory, your evidence in chief, that paragraph 46,
mm-hmm.
If you go to that.
Well, reminder, 35% is what we estimated.
And that's accurate as far as your
use of data.
The earlier questions from the Director General included one about the vegetation buffer strips document, Exhibit 11, and I think you said it was authored in 2011.
That's 2011.
Yeah, but is there evidence that in fact it's 2021.
Were you referring to the
That one.
Yes, by 2021.
So what, if any, impact does that have on your evidence about the cost inflation between those years?
I'm not sure what the inflation is running, but presumably when I compared those numbers, It was written in 2021, and it was probably based on discussions with growers in 2020.
Yeah, and finally, you were questioned about the need to maintain or clean out sediment retention ponds. Did you have a view on whether that's the sort of thing that might find its way as an action point in the FEP?
Yeah, I understand. Yep.
Thank you. That's all I had.
When you talk about the nitrogen budget, yes, which you see as a very keen on, is that the numbers in it, they're not precise numbers that tell us about kilograms of nitrogen as such, that they're more relative.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm keeping in mind we're talking about extremely variable system that varies across paddocks as much as it varies different crops. So I'm not talking about city decimal plants. Would a budget prepared for one vegetable grower be comparable to a budget prepared for another one?
Look, they'll quite unique, they're all, but the underlying model is the same. But they'll all have their own unique circumstances. I'll give you think of extreme examples. You can have a grower in the top of Waikato with a popular N-test, which is quite important, an aspect of that budget, with a number that was, from the lab, 50 kilograms, 50 milligrams of nitrogen per kilogram. That same result in Owakunin would have quite a different outcome on the budget. So the same test, the same number would have quite a different outcome because it's colder. It's not that secondary. So about really comparable. Like the underlying is comparable, but they are quite unique. And actually, quite frankly, what's unique is the discussions that they have amongst themselves as growers and trusted advisors and agronomists. That's the real power of those.
So that hot water N-test, that a sample is taken and taken to a lab for analysis. How many samples would be taken off a paddock? I mean, does it take account of the variability across the paddock?
Yeah.
Okay, so the next one, I'm not going to plug for the New Zealand Grower article of hearing it's not, but that's the slot in New Zealand Grower article of hearing it's not. Is you take into account variability by your sampling technique. So you know, and it's universal whether it's pastoral or crops. There's guidelines, there's kind of practice for the number of cores to take. This could be 10 to 20 cores taken in a representative transect or W shape. But you're right, there's no point taking a sample that's not representative.
And is that a good cost for the grower?
It's not significant. The cost, what's quite nice about the quick N-test is that the test itself is quite cheap. It's a bunch of setup, it's a dollar. The quick N-test, imagine it's like your sample when you're testing the pH. You've got to strip right, it's a dollar. The expensive part is paying somebody to go out and collect that representative sample. Absolutely, these soil testing comes with costs. But then, so does buying nitrogen, so does understanding the system.
And just one last detailed question. Do the vegetable growers typically have their own weather monitoring so they know how much rainfall and when it's occurred?
Yeah.
Temperatures.
That might be a good question to direct to the graph afterwards, but there is a weather station network and there's a company called 4Plus that provides, the growers can tap into and receive daily updates in 4Plus 4. But yeah, it's pretty good.
Thank you.
You don't have those trusted, of course.
Commissioner? I'm sure this afternoon or not yet.
Yes,
this afternoon. What I understand you to be saying is that
your recommendation is that whatever the latest version of the risk scorecard comes out of PC2 is used in the Waikato, is that correct?
Look, I think the latest version of these documents is a particular process. What I think will happen is that these will get built into the borrowing panels, which is a national standard.
Yeah, I understand the merit of it. It does seem like a relatively untested tool, doesn't it, compared to the Fonterra one, for example. And that they've been using it for several years.
Yeah. Look, absolutely.
And the introduction of the biophysical concept component is quite a significant addition. And even more of it came out, I understand, from the university, from a university professor. And I'm unsure of the merits of that and the risks involved with incorporating that. So that's an element of concern for me at the moment. I'm not sure how to deal with that. Just coming back to the correlation of risk scores of different components of the CVP risk matrix, how confident are you that the relativity is correct? And I'll just give you an example. If soil testing is so important, why does it have a risk score of 50, while other key risk elements, like an application rate, go from 60 to 250, and similarly any slope between 3 and 5 degrees has a risk score of 150. They seem to be quite different risk scores. Would you compare them to each other?
The preparation of that has been done with a group of people's knowledge and expertise in this area to try and make it relevant. I think a really, really important aspect about these risk scorecards is to keep in mind what they are there to achieve. What they are there to achieve is to ensure that the level of risk is assessed and, crucially, that the mitigations that are applied to that risk are proportionate to the level of risk. And you'll see in that scorecard that as the risk goes up, and you refer to 200 points for the higher application rates, it just means that you need to do more mitigations on that negative side, on the negative point side. So that could well be more sort of things. It's an obvious example, but you'll see there are a number of tools in there that you can do. Do you mind just point, like in my evidence I referred, I do a couple of real examples which I kind of find quite useful, and it shows the application of different mitigations and how it affects the points, and then crucially in the top line it shows what changes the grower needs to do to achieve their target for them.
I saw that, and that's going to be my next question. I wasn't trying to be flippant, the question is, where you've done a work example of showing how a farm would have to reduce from very high, I think, to low, was that still an economic farm operation, having done that?
Yeah, look, absolutely. And there's examples up and down the country of growers. These are the tools that I've been implementing now, lots of these tests, while I've said I'm new, that's still happening. Growers are still getting the hot water test, for example. Growers are doing cooking tests. I think the crucial part, though, is integrating that into the budget. That's the real big step forward, by the way, is integrating those. That's what's happening now.
Okay, thank you. And in terms of the farm environment plans, they will be prepared by the grower and the professional advisor, specialist advisor of some sort.
It can be a mixture, right? So the vegetable industry is quite different to pastoral, in that a lot of the organisations have in-house well-qualified agronomists and environmental personnel that will work on this. And don't forget, in many respects, it's activities that might already be they're hearing, right? They're already doing, we're looking at an example of erosion control or cover crops. So the principle behind the NZGAP template was that it was a tool that allowed growers to prepare their own farm environment plan. At a risk of not preparing it, is that somebody does it in isolation and it sits on the shelf and is never used. How do you get buy-in? You get buy-in by having the growers prepare their plans. They are audited. So the crucial thing about that is that audited by third parties. So you can't have, we heard earlier on about gaming, right? That's what a third party auditor avoids.
Okay. Is there a certification and audit process or just one?
Cannibal asked this question much better than me. But the auditor, the NZGAP is the third party auditor, and I'm not fully okay with that, but it's an important certification.
Okay, thank you.
But yeah, it's good.
Now, Mr. Todd, I received word that you'd like to call in the field now.
Yes, thank you. The great Mr. Ford will lead this.
Thank you, Mr. Ford.
Whereby my default that the person about to give to this court shall be approved the whole truth and nothing but the truth.
Good afternoon, Mr. Steele. Can you please confirm your full name for the court?
Kelly Annick Dune.
And did you prepare a statement of evidence in chief dated 28th of July 2023?
Yes, I did.
And do you have any corrections to your evidence?
No.
Do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and ability? I just want to pick up on one question, following on from Commissioner Hodges' question to Mr. Barber just now. Do you know anything about the certification and auditing process of the farm environment plans for growers?
Yes, so the farm environment plans will be prepared by the grower, often in conjunction with a consultant. They will be certified by a political certifier with them, and that will be audited within 12 months of being certified. If there are issues with the audit, then they will have to be re-audited, my understanding, within, depending on the level of non-compliance, would be within 6 months, 12 months, and generally within 3 years. So that will be revisited within 3 years.
That's very helpful, thank you very much indeed. And do you see that as being consistent with the farm environment plan requirements for certification and auditing?
Yes.
And would you see the same auditors and certifiers being able to do this that job?
No, I think there's different levels of skill. So the national training is actually divided now. It tends regional, I think, where certifiers and auditors have different training requirements. So I think somebody can be a certified and an auditor.
Right.
But certification is the same.
But you would hope that there would only be one certification and one audit process for both the farm environment plan process and your own industry requirements.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry, yes. Yeah, absolutely. To streamline it, more operationally streamlined and effective, it is more time for you to get doing on the ground, you know, initiative.
And do you see any reason from what you know about your existing systems why that should not apply in the future? Combined?
When you say combined, you mean just amalgamated, so that it's the one system between the NZGAP system?
Yes.
No, I don't think it's quite
better. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can you please remain for any questions from the learning briefing?
Mr. Conference official, no questions?
Yes, sir.
No questions.
Yeah.
No, thank you, sir.
Just a minute.
one matter of clarification. Hello, Ms. Dean. In paragraph 21, you and anyone who wants to set up what is sought. Now, you're aware that the lower Waikato area includes the Tongariro and catchments. Are you seeking, in terms of rotations for existing at the FMU scale, would you be comfortable with excluding the Whangarino or wetland catchments from that? And you're also seeking, I think, paragraph 22, an available, an achievable pathway for expansion. Similarly, you would accept the exclusion of the Whangarino catchments. Thank you.
Sorry, it's me again. I would first of all like to compliment you greatly on 7 pages of evidence instead of shovels over in some cases, so thank you very much for that. And you've probably gathered that one of the dilemmas for this case is that there is an overall requirement to reduce nitrogen discharges in the catchment as a whole. And that's almost non-negotiable with the Petroleum Farmana and the NPSFA. In terms of the catchment-wide reduction that's required, as far as we know at the moment, could be a 36%, 37% type reduction. How would that impact the CVP growers? Is that something that is possible, or is it just beyond the bounds of
where the expectation? I can't actually answer that for you. It's not a more quality question. What I can say is, and it sort of relates to all of the evidence that has been put forward, is that with the introduction of the freshwater farm plan and the introduction of risk assessments at Paddock Eagle and tailored solutions at Paddock Eagle, there will, I believe, that there will be significant reduction, but I can't put a numerical value on that for you.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think it's so much water quality as can the farm operate with a reduced level of nitrogen loss, I guess.
Well, it's tailored, like nitrogen costs money, so it's very much tailored to the crop requirements, and I think as research improves and development occurs, there will be additional reductions. I think too that the modelling today hasn't really reflected some of the initiatives that growers use according to good and best management practices, including solidification and rainfall was brought out monthly when rainfall is forecast, using slow release fertilisers and very much tailored to the crop requirement. I think as everything improves, you will see better tools to capture that and you will see improved reductions. But
okay,
that's
fine.
Thank you.
Do you have
a question?
Yes, thank you.
Anything arising from the commissioner's questions?
Yes.
Thank you very much for your evidence and video.
I call Sue Ruston.
Thank you.
Do you solemnly conceal the truthfully declare and affirm that the evidence you're about to give to this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
Can you please confirm your full NAP report?
Susan Chia Ruston.
And have you prepared a written statement and participated in and reported on joint witness conferencing in a in a written statement in this case?
Yes, I did.
And in doing all that, have you complied with the code of conduct for expert witnesses?
Yes, I did.
And is your evidence true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I have one correction.
Oh, yes.
In chief.
Yes. Can you tell us what that is, please?
Yeah, okay. It's on page 6. I apologize, it's kind of rather obvious omission from my list of documents that I have reviewed. So that list, which is given in paragraph 11 on page 6, that list should have included the vision and strategy for the vacation program.
And with that direction in mind, is your evidence true and correct to the best of your belief? Thank you. Well, in that case, could you please remain seated to answer any questions from my learned friends or the court? Thank you.
Mr. Coleman.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon, Ms. Russell.
Good afternoon.
I'll take you to page 14 of your evidence. Paragraph 37 about, I think, your general support for Mr. Tribulco's recommended amendments to policy 3, other than rotation, you say should be at least in New Zealand. So it's general support that you've got some changes that you recommended. And then over the page you make a similar comment in paragraph 41 about Mr. Tribulco's amendments to rule 5. So we narrow the points of difference down largely to that question of crop rotation and the way that works. If you could go to the post-conferencing version of the provisions, if you've got those there in front of you. Can we start with policy 3, which was on page 17 of that document? You're largely supportive of that policy as shown here, subject to, again, that point that I made earlier about crop rotation. And the top row of that on that topic, that you're in agreement that the policy should say what it says there about managing commercial vegetable production, including the flexibility to undertake crop rotations on multiple and or changing crops. So that's, apart from perhaps some additions at the start about providing for and managing, do you agree with the reference there to including crop rotation?
Correct.
And then A and B go on to deal with existing CDP, which is to be enabled and expanded, or expansion of CDP, which is to be provided for. Now, with expansions under B, there are some important provisos in B Roman numeral 2. You're aware of those?
Yes.
And of the water quality evidence confirming why those provisos are important, I understand. That's why you're supportive of those provisos?
Yes.
And in terms of crop rotation, is it your intention that it would be farm environment plans that are the primary mechanism to control the location of crop rotation?
So my understanding of a land use consent is that it attaches to the land, so there would have to be some disruption in the consent of the land that a consent applies to, but that could be broad, it could be narrow. If it's broad, the ability to move around within that land would have to be recognised in the EPP. Yes.
And so any constraints on where that's to be moved would be a combination perhaps of the land that gets listed in the consent and the way that EPP manages how the rotation occurs.
That's right.
Turn now to rule 5, which is this rule is defining what existing CVP is. And do you agree that condition 2 provides a grower with flexibility about how they define their own existing CVP?
So, I was present yesterday and heard some of the questions yesterday, and if I'm understanding, perhaps thinking about that question, was the potential. I think until yesterday, I had reached the rule as saying that 2A was when you established what your maximum area of land use was in any full year. And then once you've done that, for that maximum year, you then established what your subcatchment numbers were. I think I heard yesterday the possibility of reading A, where the applicant could choose which year they then sought to select the subcatchment number from. So it wasn't that you were constrained to, in that 10-year period, in the year that had the maximum number attached to it. I think there is room in that, as written, for both options to play out, but I don't think
picking
one option or the other is the root of the issue.
Yeah. So stepping through that, there's a 10-year period, 2006 to 2016, that a grower can choose, and under 2A they can choose any full year within that 10-year period. And identify their total maximum hectares of land. That's step one.
Yes, that's the potential interpretation of that that I haven't considered in 2 years, but I think that's there. That's correct.
Yes, and then I guess they could, as you said, they could choose the year that is their largest total area year, or something other than that, depending on what was most useful or suitable for them.
That's right, and that comes from some of the loose language and be around in relation to the particular year identified in A and B, so yeah.
So they would presumably look at A and B together and identify what works best overall for my operation.
That's right, within those constraints, yeah.
So it would be the same year that they've chosen, and in that year they would have a maximum total, and then they would also have totals for each subcatchment. And so if they particularly wanted to maximise total area, they could choose the biggest year, and if they wanted to maximise their ability to rotate in a particular way, they could choose the year that has the best combination of subcatchments if that grower was operating in multiple subcatchments.
That's correct, that's how I understand that could work, but my concern remains that wouldn't meet the needs of the growers in terms of reflecting their existing or potential, different growers are different, they found that the potential need for rotation across the subcatchment, so at an FMU level, to enable their current practices to be able to continue. If you are picking a year that, for example, smoothed subcatchment numbers, you could still be being constrained unnecessarily from the practice that is undertaken to date, which could be needing years of higher area in particular subcatchments and a particular cycle of rotation. So to me, that alternative interpretation that I hadn't initially applied, that they could poke their year and then establish their subcatchments, I don't think resolves the issue that I was looking at still around the calculation.
I understand. I think we'll come on to talking about that when it comes to condition 3. Just briefly, are you aware whether there are any farmers or any growers who operate solely within an individual subcatchment?
No, I'm not. That would be a question for the growers, yeah.
That's fine, thank you.
I imagine there's a possibility.
Yes.
I don't know the answer.
Some of them are large spatially, and some of them are smaller, so it may well depend on whether they're on the boundary of two or somewhere in the middle.
That's right. And I think the restrictions that the formula that is here is creating applies to those that obviously function across subfection.
Yes, that's where the particular issue that you've raised, that's where it's at its most crisp. So turning to condition three, would you agree that this condition allows crop rotation at an FMU scale, i.e. across subcatchment boundaries, if that's what the grower was doing in the reference year they selected? One is whether there's a constraint on how much they can take here. The point I'm asking you about at the moment is whether it allows them to take it here. So, if, for example, there was a grower that operated in two subcatchments in the reference year, 50% of their operation was in each of those. They could get a consent under this rule for existing CVP that would enable them to rotate, as long as they had no more than the total area in each of those, but they could swap the crops between them
that's
in whatever combination they want.
Yeah, that's correct. The issue that I was instructed to focus on was those constraints. Yes, you can have 50% in both areas and you can move your activities between it, but that's not where the problem lies. That lies when there is variation across the subcatchments in terms of the hectareage needed over the cycle of rotation.
Yes, so understanding that point, coming back to the part about what this condition allows, this condition does allow crop rotation at an FMU scale. If that's what the grower was doing in their reference year.
The problem is it may not allow for the full extent of crop rotation.
So if we can separate that out, is the answer to my question yes, but I still see a constraint on it that I'm concerned about?
The answer is, in my mind, is that a grower can move their operation to land that is authorised for CVP, so that may be between subcatchments. The full extent of rotation may not be achieved by that condition.
Yes, so that is a yes, but in the way that I framed it before.
I'm trying to be clear about what we mean by the term rotation. We're effectively suggesting that part rotation is rotation, and I think it's important to be clear that what the growers need is the full extent of their existing rotation practices.
The the condition here doesn't restrict the grower to using exactly the same land parcels that they were using in that reference here, does it? As long as the total area of land they're using in any given sub-catchment doesn't increase?
Yes, that's correct.
And so that would enable them to shift onto different land within those sub-catchments. For example, if the grower had some land on the edge of an urban area and they sold that to be developed, they could shift that growing area somewhere else in that same sub-catchment. This condition wouldn't restrict it.
They could do that provided there was a land use consent that identified that area of land as being authorised for CVP.
Well, I want to test that a little further. The land use consent wouldn't necessarily need to identify the specific land they were moving to, would it, under this condition, because they are limited to an area in hectares in that sub-catchment rather than specifically being limited to precise land parcels. Would you accept that?
My understanding of the Act, which section it is, but it's a land use consent attaches to the land. So my understanding of that is that the area of land, whether it be broad or narrow, must be identified in that land use consent.
I understand, so that's where that particular concern relates to.
So then also part of condition one.
Well, yes, this is the one where property and properties used for crop rotation are registered. And then there's also condition four, which refers to identifying the farm environment plan as far as practicable areas anticipated for CVP crop rotation. So there's a combination there.
Are those two different things?
I would expect them to align, but it's possible that at the point at which someone prepares a farm environment plan, they get some updated information if they're updating that farm environment plan. But at the point of applying for consent, I would anticipate that they're identifying as clearly as possible where those all are.
I agree, that's how I've approached it. I wonder then why the conditions. Condition one has a registration requirement by a consent holder as opposed to a global record or register kept by the council, and then condition four in the FEP, which I would have thought would be getting down to brass tacks, would be saying this is the area which over the foreseeable future I intend to be using for commercial vegetable production, including cycles of crops and cycles of fallow land.
Yes.
Alright. I don't know if that helps you very much.
I was sitting here nodding, I'm agreeing with what you're saying.
I just wonder, Mr. Conroy, we might take a break in a moment and can think this through. I just wonder if the goal of the council and the goal of the growers not aligned in relation to this, except that I'm not sure that the difference between them relates to the issue of keeping a lid on the amount of CDP land overall for the purposes of achieving objectives 1 and 2 of PC1. It seems to me that we've got almost a registration or a bureaucratic issue rather than an effects based issue.
Sir, I think there are two parts to it. I agree with you that the difference appears to be, I think what you're saying is the difference appears to be small. And what I'm endeavouring to establish is that actually the provisions do allow for crop rotation at an FMU scale, but with constraints. And so there we get to the second point. The question would be, and naturally this will be a matter for submission now, is there a reason, a justifiable reason, to have constraints on the extent of rotation or expansion? With expansion, it's accepted. The answer is yes.
Yeah.
With rotation, that's the point we're ultimately needing to test.
and I understand, and I know that this was part of the conversation I had with your colleague, Mr. Fisher, yesterday, is also to ensure that there's an adequate basis for monitoring to ensure that rotation is not a cover for extension. Well, I wonder if we might just take a break now and return at 2:15 and pursue this further at that stage, in terms of your questions at this point.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Ruston, that does mean